Here's a question we've been discussing. Is the U.S. dollar nearing the end of its global hegemony? Today, I invited a guest to talk about this, and maybe one of the few people that I really wanted to hear from the most during this tumultuous week in global finance. Nick Bhatia is the author of the book Layered Money. I've referred to it often. He's also an adjunct professor of finance at USC Marshall School of Business and founder of The Bitcoin Layer. This is a book that not only explains blockchain currency, but explains the history of currencies and helps really explain what we've been going through, where we've been and where we're going next. I find it an invaluable resource. So, Nick, thank you so much for joining me. I quote your book often because I found it both practical but also prophetic. So why did you write this book? Did you see, because when you wrote it, we weren't in the midst of this financial crisis, but it felt like you saw that coming. Can I ask you, was it just because you were reading the tea leaves, or was it really in the numbers?
Well, the reason I wrote the book is because I wanted to explain Bitcoin in a new way that hadn't been done before. And I knew in order to do that, I had to give a history of money through my lens, which was as a bond market trader. That's the background that I come from. I've spent time in the US Treasury market on a desk, on a strategy desk, and just thinking through the US monetary system from the Fed and Treasury perspective. And when I look at the quantity of money provided to the system, whether explicitly or implicitly by the Federal Reserve over the last, let's say, since 2007, it becomes obvious that there are such big holes in the financial system, mm-hmm. that only the central bank is able to put bandages on.
Yeah.
And in that way, we have to explain Bitcoin in the context of the current financial system, which is a fractional reserve system that has broken in several places from 2007 to 2020 and has been bandaged by the Federal Reserve in all these places. And it only guarantees more monetary stimulus from the Fed as the economy goes through its business cycle, which is part of my, research as well.
Now, this week, China and Brazil decided to work around the U.S. dollar. So a lot of the shakiness of the U.S. dollar that you base your argument on is happening. We see similar agreements with Russia, Argentina, France, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia. So in giving us the history of currency and then the history of the U.S. dollar, you show us why this is such a shaky place to sort of stake our claims. So do you agree that right now the U.S. dollar is kind of, for lack of a better expression, circling the drain and making the case that we need an alternate currency?
Not necessarily. So I believe that the U.S. dollar and the Federal Reserve's position and the U.S. fiscal position, all of these impact the trustworthiness of the dollar on the global scale. That is undeniable. We can see China, Russia, other countries that have made serious efforts toward going away from the dollar in terms of its dependency. Now, with that being said, the dollar, in terms of its usage in global trade and its position in debt capital markets, as well as asset management, which is wealth storage, the dollar is the primary tool, and it's actually by several miles the leader on that front. And then take it one step further, what would be or what could be the challenger to the dollar on that front? I'm talking about true international settlement, global capital markets, and the denomination of the balance sheets of corporations around the world, and the debt and debt and equity that they issue. There, if you look to China and you look to Europe, and Russia doesn't even have an international currency. Europe does, and China doesn't have an internationalized currency, but they're making certain efforts. So between China and between the EU, neither one of them has a currency that is even remotely positioned to challenge the dollar on a global capital market basis. So I want to establish that. But then if you take it one step further, we're talking about Bitcoin. Bitcoin benefits from the concept that all of the central banks and all of the countries around the world are competing with each other. And so in that global race to the bottom, you're saying circling the drain of the dollar. It's not only the dollar, though. It's all of the central bank currencies currently have no ability to sustain themselves in their current form. So they have to devalue against each other over time. And so, but in that relationship, I still do believe the dollar remains dominant for many, many years to come. And that the talk of China establishing international relationships over the yuan is slightly overblown and has been in the news really constantly since the year 2010, when the financial crisis was really starting to just slow down a little bit. Then you saw China start to make these announcements that we're going to go away from the dollar. Well, it's 13, 14 years later, and we still haven't seen any true internationalization or China opening its capital account, meaning that you can't actually settle yuan around the world. It's not possible without permission of the Chinese government. So we are still miles away from the dollar being challenged by other government currencies.
Okay. So what you're saying then is it's not just the dollar, it's all fiat currencies. And you present here this idea of king dollar. You say, amidst the global currency war, the dollar emerged as the cleanest dirty shirt in the laundry of global currencies. You say that the pound sterling abandoned a gold standard in 1931 and officially ended its reign as world reserve currency. So that void was filled by the United States, but it's still sort of just one side of the same coin of fiat currencies. Is that a more accurate description?
Well, if you think about when the U.S. took over from the British pound sterling as the world reserve currency, this happened over several decades between, call it, the late 1800s and 1930s. But by 1970s, the U.S. had abandoned the gold standard itself. And so the U.S. dollar has stood on its own ground, meaning the source of the value of the dollar comes from a combination of trust, military prowess, property rights, etc., all the things that make the United States the United States, that is what the dollar stands upon. So if you compare military prowess and you compare the internationalization of the currency, the trust in the rule of law, and relate it to other nations, not just in general, but relate it to other nations, you can see why the dollar might have a very long runway. Because if you compare property rights in the United States and China, what result is that going to spit out to you as an analyst when making the decision between these two currencies over a multi-decade timeframe?
Right.
It's not easy to see China taking over the role of a global reserve currency from the United States, given what we know, because China isn't going suddenly to some commodity-backed currency that is going to attract demand and sustain value versus other things that might decline as fiat currencies devalue. So if that becomes the case, it's a different conversation. But as I see it right now, it's just not the case that China can really take that international currency role away from the dollar.
Now, what can we learn from the recent bailouts of the banking sector? You write that the Fed uses wholesale money and people use retail money. So the Fed was able to bail out banks with a different layer of money. How is that now going to affect us all? Because I heard you on the Tom Wheelwright podcast talking about how we didn't actually feel the full effects of the 2008 crisis. And so does this bailout mean we will feel it? And how will this affect all of us?
Well, if you think about the way that the Federal Reserve issues money to cover losses in the financial system, and it always teams up with the Treasury, right? Because the Treasury is the entity that has to support the FDIC, which has to support the banks in times of crisis. And then the Federal Reserve comes in and has their own facilities to backstop the system and guarantee liquidity to the system. So what we saw, despite seeing one new liquidity facility from the Fed, this BTFP facility, besides that, we saw nothing new. And so all we saw is another attempt to paper over the fractional reserve nature of the system by guaranteeing additional FDIC deposits beyond that $250,000 level. And that moving it from $250,000 to the theoretical infinity, or let's just say multi-millions, that move from 250 to, let's say, 10 million is nothing different than the move from 100 to 250 during the 2008 crisis. And it's no different from moving it from, you know, it was originally between $3,000 and $5,000 when it came about in the 1930s. And so the increase of the amount of the federal deposit insurance backstop is in actuality nothing new. And what can we expect as Americans or as participants in the US dollar from this? Nothing new. We are in a global currency war that has been in effect for a decade and a half. Yeah. It is a rotation between easing of around the world, right? We've been in a tightening situation here in the US for the last year plus, but that's because we've had this, you know, inflation episode that the Fed had to address. But once that fades, we'll be back into this devaluation rotation that we've been in for quite a long time.
And so the solution that you see then is a cryptocurrency such as Bitcoin, specifically Bitcoin, because you present this idea of layered currency as if, you know, there was one-time coins and then there's gold and then there's paper money and then there's, you know, numbers in a computer that we agree is money. But you think that this can be flipped. Can you explain this pyramid of a different layer of money in which Bitcoin is the dominant layer? I don't know if dominant's the right word, the top layer.
Sure. So Bitcoin is not issued by a country nor a company. It doesn't have any counterparty risk. It's actually a digital commodity. And in that way, we can compare it to gold historically, in that gold is a commodity. It doesn't have any counterparty risk. Nobody owes you the gold coin that's in your pocket. And in a similar way, if you have custody of Bitcoin private keys that give you signing rights to a balance on this ledger, you have money on your person, and that money is not owed to you, and it exists in ledger form on all the Bitcoin nodes around the world, and that's thousands of computers that keep this record. So there's no one server or one place that you could even bomb to shut this network down and this proof of ownership network. And in that way, Bitcoin has established itself as the preeminent and the dominant digital commodity in the world. And that digital commodity, I do view, will be used as a store of value to escape this competitive devaluation nature of fiat currencies, but it doesn't mean it will replace it and become the rails for all financial transactions over any medium-term time horizon. However, I do see Bitcoin taking a role of digital gold, being a store of value that people are able to keep outside of the current global state-issued currency or even bank-issued currency system that we use today.
You write that Bitcoin thrives amidst instability, and we see that happening this week. Bitcoin is hitting highs for the year as, you know, people are kind of scrambling about our economy and this exactly right now. And so is this what you would have expected Bitcoin to do amidst the geopolitical system?
It's a good question. And to be very honest with you, Bitcoin and its price behavior, it's such a volatile asset that it's almost difficult to judge any few weeks of price action based off of the news, because what we saw last year is an incredibly strong correlation between Bitcoin and the stock market. And as rates rose, we had risk assets fall in price as, you know, the discount rate increases, the present value of cash flows decrease. And we saw that happen to stocks, and we saw Bitcoin fall in sympathy. But it's not even in sympathy, it's because it's owned at the portfolio level by the same people that own stocks. And so they do trade as correlated assets. With that being said, Bitcoin has responded nicely to a banking crisis, for sure, and it has outperformed the S&P by a significant margin during the last couple weeks, really, since the Silicon Valley demise. But in that way, interest rates have also come down over that time horizon, which is, in theory, should be supportive to Bitcoin, as we saw, you know, that correlation last year. When rates rose, Bitcoin fell. This year, rates are falling and Bitcoin is rising. So it's really hard to pinpoint the why. Rather, I like to look at Bitcoin's 200-week moving average, which is like a four-year average price of Bitcoin. It's in a steady state of increase, and has been since that average came about, 4 years after Bitcoin's price history. So we see Bitcoin steadily increasing in price, and I do believe that that will continue.
Interesting. All right. Well, thank you so much. And I appreciate that you're unwilling to speak in hyperbole. Like I said, I've learned a lot from your book. I appreciate it a lot. And I want to recommend it again. So you can follow Nick Bhatia on Twitter at Time Value of BTC. You can seek out the book as well. Is there anything else you'd like to share with us before we let you go?
Sure. People can find all my work right now at thebitcoinlayer.com. We have a free newsletter and we have a YouTube channel, which is also free. So a lot of content for people to check out. We analyze Bitcoin through a global macro lens.
Okay. Thank you again for your time.
Thank you.
Today's episode is brought to you by Indeed. Well, the thing about running your own business is that every single hire counts. No hiring partner understands that like Indeed. Indeed is the hiring platform where you can attract, you can interview, you can hire all in one place. Don't spend hours on multiple job sites looking for candidates with the right skills when you can do it all with Indeed. My mom runs a nonprofit in Pennsylvania. She's the CEO. They use Indeed to all of their hiring. It's amazing. My sister-in-law works at a large landscaping company in California. They use Indeed for all of their hiring. We here at Redacted use Indeed for all of our hiring. And what's amazing is if you hate waiting, this is the beauty of Indeed. Indeed's US data shows that over 80% of Indeed employers find quality candidates whose resume on Indeed matches their job description the moment they sponsor a job. And I love how easy it is because I just don't have the time. I really don't. I have no time. So when we post a job posting, I want to be able to see the matches, the instant match that they have. It's amazing because it just gives me the candidates I want. I don't have to sift through thousands of resumes. It's really, really great. So join 3 million businesses worldwide using Indeed to get great talent, hire great talent fast. Indeed knows when you're growing your own business, you have to make every dollar count. That's why with Indeed, you only pay for quality applications that match your must-have job requirements. Indeed knows hiring needs to be cost-effective when you're running your own business. They know when you're doing everything for your company, you can't afford to overspend. So here's what I want you to do. Visit Indeed.com/redacted to start hiring right now. Just go to Indeed.com/redacted. Indeed.com/redacted. Terms and conditions apply. Cost per application. Pricing not available for everyone. If you need to hire, you need Indeed.